Is this working?
Probably. Good. So it's nice to be here again, although the actual overlap between the people who were here the last time that I came and the people who are here now is actually, I would say, about, what, 10%, 15%? So it's like a new place. Anyhow, so today what I want to do is actually, it's a talk that's composed out of two talks, but there's a theme which actually when we were doing the research we didn't realize. So let me go with the theme first and then explain. So these two ideas here, or results, seem to suggest that we're used to thinking about gravity and solutions and black holes that are solutions of gravity. So somehow gravity is more fundamental and black holes are derived quantities from gravity. But these two seem to suggest that maybe black holes are more fundamental than gravity. So that you can derive gravity if you know some properties of black holes. You can derive properties of gravity from those, which is kind of strange, but I'll show you the results. I don't have something more solid to base my feeling on that, but these somehow go in the same direction. So the first one. Well, here you see here we will assume certain properties of black hole and get information on the coupling of gravity, on the coupling parameter of gravity. Which there's no reason that this should happen. So if you can get the scales, the equation of motion and the coupling by assuming certain properties of black hole, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe. Anyhow. So the first subject or the first result that I want to show you is that the equations of motion of gravity, so any theory, any metric theory of gravity, are equivalent to the fundamental thermodynamic relation. This is an idea that started about 15 years ago by Ted Jacobson and has some history. Instead of sort of going through historical review, let me just present the result since we have a lot on our plate. And if you ask me, I'll tell you what I'll tell you about the history. And then the second one will be using properties of semi-classical black holes to put a bound on the gravitational couplings. This is closely related to entropy bounds, but we haven't yet succeeded in turning this into an entropy bound. So if you, in Einstein theory, this is an entropy bound. Okay, so let's start. So the idea here is that the idea in deriving this equivalence between the thermodynamics and equation of motion is that you can boost yourself at any given point, get an acceleration horizon, and use the idea that properties of acceleration horizons are the same as properties of black hole horizons. And from that, you can deduce the equations. So what we need to do is identify three quantities: temperature, heat, so heat transfer, temperature, and entropy. And these two quantities were already identified previously, and our contribution would be to identify delta S, and we will identify it as the Nesser charge entropy that Wald introduced, that generalizes the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for theories that are extensions of Einstein theory. Okay, so here's my general theory, and I'm splitting it to three pieces. One piece contains the metric without derivative and all matter that I denote here as phi. Now, if there are covariant derivatives acting on phi, and there are enough of them so that you can commute them and expose explicit factors of the Riemann tensor, the prescription, same prescription that Wald uses, is that you have to expose them and plug them in either here or here. And the idea is that the split can be done. So we have the metric, matter, and the Riemann tensor as our variables. Again, this is not new to us. This idea is essentially Wald's idea. In yours, I don't know, Ted said that you were contemporary with him. I'm not sure.
With Wald? Well, yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, we didn't do any complete generality, but that's actually.
Okay. So I never got the actual story from him, but my impression was that he feels that you should get equal credit. Anyhow, let's not fight about that. So temperature is the easiest. You just define surface gravity by taking this standard definition using the Killing vector, the Killing horizon, and defining the temperature using this. And you have to do it in a limiting procedure, but everybody agrees that that's okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sure.
Is it applicable even when you have multiple derivatives acting on a scalar field? I thought there was some restriction.
No. In fact, there is a big chunk of work in his paper with Ian devoted exactly to that, showing that you can actually do it. You work with symmetries and anti-symmetries, and then he goes through a very tedious effort showing that that's the case. And in all the examples that we've checked, and we've checked some pretty complicated examples, and it seems to work. So maybe somewhere there's a hidden obstacle, but I haven't encountered it yet. Okay, so that's it. The heat in this delta Q equals TDA is again something that pretty much agreed upon. You start with the definition of the energy. So this epsilon is essentially proportional to the normalized Killing vector. So you should think about it as just before your, as a limiting procedure. So this guy is time-like. And this quantity is essentially T00. And now you need to define the flux, essentially, or the variation of E. And we define it as by taking the direction on derivative in the direction of the Killing vector. So it's basically, again, you think about it as time-like, and you just see the difference. So there's an observer hovering outside the horizon, and the energy difference between two neighboring places that are connected along the time-like, along the chi direction, is the energy flux, essentially. Now, when you compute it, you see that it has two terms, one when this derivative acts on the energy momentum tensor, and the other one when it acts on the chi, and then it gives back chi and the surface, surface gravity, which you take away. Now, this one is, quote unquote, a real energy flux. So if you have, you can imagine a situation where even before the boost, you had some energy flux going on in this neighborhood, and this would be present regardless of the acceleration. So that's something that we basically need to ignore. It's not the energy flux or the heat flux that associated with the accelerated observer or with the presence of the horizon. And we are left with this quantity here, which we identify as a delta Q, and this also agrees with the definition of Jacobs. Okay, so we're done with two quantities. We did T, we did delta Q, and now we need to do delta S. Yep.
Sure.
Go ahead. But how do you normalize kappa?
Meaning?
Well, if I'm really in flat space, am I not, isn't that normalized to a different, you know, different observers are going to see different kappas? And so you have to say that the proper norm of chi is one on this light
right
over here.
Right. So
but if you're working infinitesimally, with an infinitesimal bit of flat space.
Yeah, I must admit that this is something, so we didn't actually go through all the details of that procedure, but Ted apparently did. So I'm
appeal to my friend.
Although now we have some argument with him or debate, let's say, because his definition of delta S is different than ours. But that, I think, the part about defining temperature and delta Q, I think enough people looked at it so they can trust that the normalization in epsilon work were done properly. I went through his calculations, and they seem fine. And eventually it seems to fit, so I didn't find any actual reason to find a problem, to look for a problem there. Okay. So now let me make a proposal for the entropy. So I'm cheating a little bit here because I'm presenting it upside down. So the real way that we arrived at that is we were looking for a quantity that when I equate it to 1 over T delta Q will be equivalent to the equation of motion. And we had a guess that this should be the entropy, but so I'm presenting it upside down like they do it in math classes. So here is an expression similar towards entropy. So I take a volume and I write an entropy by integrating this quantity over the boundary of that volume. And then I use the basically Stokes' theorem to write it as a derivative of this quantity on the volume itself. And if I have that, then again, I'm using my definition of the variation as the directional derivative in the direction of the Killing vector to define my delta x. Same way that I did with the delta q. Okay, so you see, this is a quite complicated expression, but you can work with it. This I already said. Now, this you can actually work out in this formalism what the equations of motion are. This was did that in full generality, and this is the answer. It's less complicated than one might expect, but still not a very simple expression. Anyhow, that's what we have. Now, remember the split that we had. So we split it like so. And so in this case, our matter and interaction and the momentum terms are given like so. And using these definitions, I can write the equations. The equations for any generalized gravity. Yeah, sure.
The covariant derivative is acting on the Riemann tensor as well?
Yes, the action is here, you mean in the Lagrangian?
Yeah.
Yes, there could be arbitrary covariant derivative acting.
How do you handle those operationally when you work out the equation?
Oh, it's the same way that you in all the Lagrangian equations. You just, if you want to take the, you integrate by parts and you expose the, yeah, this, the user, it's a user perfection as in the other quantity. Or you just take derivatives of the appropriate function of the derivative.
No, but isn't your, well, the wall formula would be different for each theory when you increase the number of derivatives, right?
When I write the function derivative with respect to R with four indices,
yeah.
I don't mean that it's just that function that you just derive with respect to R with four indices without any derivative. It's like the Euler Lagrange equation when I have, let's say, I write n of phi, and it could be,
okay,
so I do delta L, delta phi, equal to zero, and whenever there are derivatives, I need to integrate them by part and work out the expression. So it's a mnemonic for doing the full correct equation of motion. And again, this is worked out explicitly in world and in expressions that we've checked, it works out correctly. So for example, if you have two derivatives, you have to, this would be, if you wanted to write it in a sort of, in the normal way, it would be two derivatives acting on the, this expression. So there would be additional derivatives acting. In the same way that if you have a Lagrangian with double time derivatives, you would perform it. Again, this is, I think, it doesn't seem to be, at least, there doesn't, I couldn't find any issues associated with this type of things. So, here we are. And now we need to compare these general equation of motion. The equation of motion of general gravity to our equation here. So I'm just writing delta Q, T delta S. And I need to compare it to this equation. So you see, we're almost there.
And we're missing this term, which is coming. You can see what's written here. It's, if you work, if the derivative is tacked on this, the epsilon, they give you a term like that. And when you do the algebra, you actually get exactly the an exact equivalence between the two. Now, the one thing that you that is not fixed by this relation is the there's a function proportional to g mu times a function, and that function from conservation of t mu nu, you can show that it must be a constant. So this means that you can add the cosmological term, and this cosmological term, these equations will be blind to cosmological terms. Again, that's pretty straightforward. So, yes, sure.
I didn't get it. How you define your entropy and how you define the heat transfer? It seems that you define them in such a way that you get this equation, isn't it?
No, the from if you're, as I said, I will not, since I wasn't reviewing the background, then you're absolutely, and if you are not aware of the background, then your conclusion from what I presented is correct. But the point here is that this expression is actually an expression that exists. This is the, if you use black holes and you want to calculate their entropy for a general theory of gravity, this is essentially the expression that you use. This is what Wald and Kang, Jacobson, and Myers do. So I haven't invented that. This and the delta Q, after you think about it, it's actually pretty reasonable. So all these, this has a background, and this choice of entropy actually makes sense. It's borrowed directly from the expression that you would use for black holes. So it relates to the theme that I was telling you about. You use ideas from black hole physics and you apply them.
So as far as I understood, the entropy is defined through the black hole analogy because there is this.
The reason why you needed to define it this way is Wald was looking for a conserved quantity that satisfied the first law. And this is the net of charge associated. This is the net of charge. The entropy that he defines. And in fact, we can show using this that it satisfies also the second law. So it's a reasonable quantity for entropy.
Oh, and the definition of heat is based on the definition of energy which was in the previous transparent, right?
Well, the definition of energy is pretty standard.
Yeah.
If these were time-like vectors, then this would be the energy.
And TAB is the energy momentum.
The full energy momentum tensor of the two.
Including gravity.
Including the you remember there were matter and the mixed term.
Yeah.
So it includes that.
What happens with gravitational waves?
What happens with
TAB is zero there.
Okay.
And so you wouldn't be including that as an energy. You're going to ignore that. You're going to be confused.
If you have a flow of energy, this term that I was discussing. If you have a flow of energy that exists there regardless of the acceleration horizon, I'm ignoring. That has to do with this probably you can include and then include the normal entropy associated with them. So I'm interested in the entropy and heat associated with the existence of the acceleration horizon. But that's actually, that can be a nice addition. And we've been thinking about it, but we didn't have time to do it, is to try and see what happens if you actually include a regular heat flow. So for example, a thermal, not necessarily gravity waves, but thermal stuff, and see how it fits us. But we didn't do it.
But what did we really learn here, though? Because at a certain step here, you know, there's a Lagrangian. So given the Lagrangian, I know
it's the next transparency. So
okay,
just 2 minutes. Let's postpone it for 2 minutes and we'll discuss that. Because it's actually, I think, at the moment, it's sort of fluctuating between different answers about to this question. So let me just, what I'll do is just make this comment and then let's discuss that. So a bonus, which to the best of my knowledge, this was never proved before, that this world entropy actually satisfies the second law. First law was designed to satisfy the first law, but the second law, there was no proof. And here the proof is almost immediate, because here is the equation delta Q equals dds. So I write it like so. And you see that if the, in this case, if the null energy, if this EAB satisfies the null energy condition, then the second law is satisfied. Null energy condition means that this product is a positive, semi definite positive, larger or equal to zero for all vectors that are null four times. Okay, good. So,
can you remind me what went into that TAB? I'm sorry.
Okay, so that TAB, right, it's coming from, it's the normal definition of TAB coming from this guy and that guy. And we actually, in this paper, we actually proved that this separation is consistent due to an insisting referee. So we actually proved that it is consistent and that there, the total is conserved, et cetera, et cetera. So
there's a surprise there in that if I write down an ordinary matter Lagrangian, where I know that condition is satisfied, then I could have more interesting LGs.
Right.
But as soon as you write down L hint, I don't think there's any guarantee that the null energy condition is satisfied, is there?
No, it's so you're saying, can we get situations in which the second law will be violated? That's now in this case, I think to answer that, you need to, so with as with all these energy conditions and so on, they are an indication. So my attitude towards them is like so. Violation of the non-energy condition are indications that maybe something is going bad. And so if you have a specific system where the non-energy condition is violated, you should look specifically for the physical problem that is either present or not present. If it's present, then you throw it away. If it's not present, I think in this case you have to accept it. But this is in this sense, it's a sort of standard way of trying to classify what might be good Lagrangians. And so it's the sort of, it's the first step. And then you have to do better. For example, with the, we know that quantum effects vary the null energy. That's why black holes can radiate and the horizon can shrink. So I wouldn't, in this case, I wouldn't it just puts this on the similar grounds as all the other ideas that are associated with the second law. And if they can be violated, maybe this one can be violated. And I haven't done an exhaustive check of whether, what type of interaction will lead to non-energy violation and so on. But I think it's an indication that those, the two, one needs to check them further. Okay, so now.
May I ask two more questions?
Sure.
First, you said that you will find the first law of thermodynamics, and this is, as I understand, the second law.
Yes.
Yeah. And first law is actually, it looks for me, maybe I'm wrong, that it is automatic because it is colliding.
Yes, but it's automatic if you choose the correct entropy. That's what works here.
Okay, sure.
So after you choose the correct entropy, it is automatic because it was designed this way. I agree.
Yeah, to some extent, but in principle, if you don't play these games with entropy, it just follows the you want conservation of energy. It's part of covariance because it's energy conservation. Then your quantum corrections automatically, quantum effects automatically follow covariance.
Okay. Yeah.
And on the other hand, we know that energy conditions can be violated, let's say, by semi-classical corrections.
Mm-hmm.
Then you are in trouble because it means that you violate second law of thermodynamics.
But this is for that. This is the same issue as we were discussing right now. If you do the same in Einstein theory, you think that in this case the non-energy condition is violated, and the energy. If you just look at the energy of the black hole, the energy of the black hole is decreasing. If the area shrinks, that's the area theory, right? So if the area shrinks, there's an apparent problem with the second law of thermodynamics. But that, in the Einstein case, that has been resolved in several ways. And we know that it's okay. There is no real physical problem with that. So as I was answering to Rob, this is essentially at the same level. You would expect classical sources to obey this condition, and you would expect quantum sources not to obey this condition. So if you find classical sources that do not obey the conditions, you have to check them further just to see if there is an instability or some physical problem. So you don't, it's not like a dictate from above that you shouldn't violate any of these energy conditions, just as an indication that you have to check further to verify that your system is a good system. Yes. But the point here, the sort of progress here, is that previously also with regular energy momentum conditions, you couldn't formulate this proof. You couldn't show that delta S is positive, even for PEVs that where you actually expect it to be. Okay, so now we're actually starting this question of what have we learned. And okay, so here I would say that there are hints, but I cannot say that I fully understand the consequences of this. So one thing that you could do is say, okay, we see that the idea that serration horizons behave as black hole horizon has some validity to it. If you actually take it to the limit, we know that the entropy that's associated with serration horizons is entanglement entropy. And so perhaps
the entropy that's associated with the black hole horizons is also infinite. So that's one possible lesson that we may take from this. Another one is even more radical. So let's say that somebody, for example, in string theory, somebody counts for us states and computes entropy in a microscopic way. That can be done. Okay? So there, S is given, since we know the energy momentum tensor of the theory. We know also the Q and the temperature we agreed on. So in this case, this suggests that from counting and knowing microscopic properties of matter, you can deduce the equation of motion of gravity. And I think it's an interesting possibility, and it is probably possible to check it by taking systems where we can count and seeing whether the counting agrees with the gravity theory that is associated with the systems.
So can I ask for clarification?
Yes.
So in string theory, the system that we can count are external black holes that tease you. So what would you check there?
Well, first of all, you can also, it's true that these are the easiest to count, but you can also count near extreme black holes and small. I'm thinking particularly about small black holes. So those where
those are also
gravity.
Yes. Small black holes also have p equal to zero, in but we can count in string theory.
Right, but the so. But in any case, I think it is possible to do the counting also somewhat away from externality. So perhaps that can be. I don't have a concrete example, but this sounds like an interesting step, an interesting calculation to be done. So the idea would be that from the counting, you would be able to deduce the gravity equations of that produce the object whose states you're counting. Okay. Not much time left for this one. Second part is a statement saying, so let me define a gravitational tooth coupling. So it's almost as a gauge tooth coupling. So N times T Newton, and I have to make it dimensionless, so I divide by some length. N is the number of light species of the tube. So, and they, I will define it more precisely. In a few transactions. Okay, so they're defined here. So mass less than cutoff and width less than mass. You have a theory, matter of matter, including the gravitons and what have you. You just look at the spectrum and you count how many of them have masses below the cutoff, how many of them their width is less than their mass. I'm not putting numerical factors, so in all of this. So that's the typical way of defining them. And I'm defining my UV cutoff in configuration space as the length scales length scale above which exchange of metric perturbation becomes strong. So it's a perturbative way of defining when gravity becomes strong. If I look at the one particle exchange and it's the two particle exchange is as big as the one particle exchange, this is my definition of where I need to cut off the theory. And this has been used in the extra dimensions and in many other cases, and it's a reasonable definition. Okay, the comment that I want to make here is that what I will do now is I will use a different parameterization of extensions of Einstein's theory. Previously, I used a Lagrangian expanded in powers of curvatures, which is a typical way that I used to do it. And here I will have to use a different way, parameterizing, because the previous way was in the expansion is not very useful to actually prove what I want to do. So let's define a length scales that we call length scales of semi-classical black hole. So it's a definition. It's the Planck length, the usual Planck length, times the square root of n. N is the number of species. Okay? Those of you who have seen entropy bounds know that this length scale enters also there. Now, and this is the definition of the gravitational analog of the proof coupling. So first, so here's how I want to proceed with the proof. I will first show that this coupling is less than unity for all length scales that are larger than this LSCBH. That would be the first step. Second step is I will show that this LSCBH is essentially the scale of the smallest semi-classical black hole. And then I will argue that this UV cutoff in configuration space has to be larger than LSCBH. So using this way, if I do all these three steps, I will get at a proof that this gravitational coupling at any scale larger than the LUV is bounded by unity. So it's somehow saying, and this has, if true, this has interesting consequences. I don't know how. Okay, so let's go quickly about what are the assumptions about semi-classical black holes. So we need a way of characterizing what are semi-classical black holes, and we found five ways of characterizing them. All of them are equal in Einstein, and in general, only two of them will remain. So one thing essentially saying that their horizon scale doesn't shrink at the speed of light, or shrink slower than the speed of light. H bar and C are unity here. The temperature doesn't change at a rate faster than speed of light. This one, what is this? Oh, this is a dimensionless way of characterizing a slow variation of the mass. And this is, again, another dimensionless way of characterizing a variation of the mass. We have to keep these three parameters separate because in general theories of gravity, the relation is different than in the Einstein theory. And we impose that the decay width of the black hole in the same way that the light speed. So in this one is saying that the black holes are part of the spectrum. Okay, and these are all reasonable definitions, and they hold in any of the black hole solutions that we recognize. Now, the two main assumptions that we make about black holes is, one, that they emit as black bodies. We do all of this in four dimensions, but it's easily extended to D dimension. And it works. So this is assumption number one. And assumption number two is that basically RS over beta is smaller than one. For neutral black holes, RS beta is equal to one up to numerical factor. Say, basically, a manifestation of the fact that the temperature of the black hole is a geometric object. It's not related to the Lagrangian whose solution the black hole is. It's just related to the geometry, and you can actually check that. You can check this for in many cases, and it works. And so for neutral black holes, it actually is saturated. Okay. So I can use this one to narrow down the number of conditions. So I do it graphically like so. Right, there's a relation between beta and RS, so these two can be narrowed to one. Again, relationship between RS and beta tells me that I can narrow it to single. And now I can use these two, see? Again, use the relationship between RS and beta to show that these two are equivalent. So I don't need them. Now, if you write it explicitly, you see that these two, so you use this expression for the MDT, and you find these two inequalities. So these two inequalities have to be obeyed by semi-classical black holes as we define them for any theory. We will see that this is actually, we can, is of order unity or less, so we can again narrow down the resulting analysis shows that semi-classical black holes have to obey, this is a number, right? This is a number, and that number has to be bigger than n, regardless of the theory that produced.
Did you implicitly assume that these are around that?
No.
But if you have something that is asymptotically ADS, wouldn't you have the around the length scale, which is the ADS radius?
Okay, let me retract that. The way I'm presenting it, in the way that we wrote the paper, yes, you're right. We have to assume asymptotic flatness. I think that there shouldn't be much difference. I don't see, there may be some differences in ADS, but as I'm thinking about them, I cannot see
Area.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. But you can have a black hole in ADS where that assumption is valid. So I think the question is whether the real asymptotic scope. So obviously near this black hole, we don't really care if it's an ADS or flat space. And
It's true that what I've used are formula for flat space, but I cannot see a point where that becomes a problem. So most likely this holds also in non-asymptotically flat spaces, but I cannot say that I actually can do a calculation that shows.
When you say you used a flat space formula, it's just number one there? Or?
Which one?
Just capital
here for food. No, this is this basically saying that they emit as black bodies. So if I just wrap them.
So what was the flat space formula?
No, you will see coming up next.
Oh,
so that's why I answered first that it's that I haven't used it, but then after rethinking. But I do not see how the asymptotics comes in. Yeah. But it probably would be nice to actually check it explicitly for ADS. Good. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's now work explicitly for Einstein gravity and see how it works. So for Einstein gravity, we know what's the relationship between M and RS is. So in this case, RS, M larger than N, and these two are all equivalent to this condition, saying that the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole in Einstein gravity has to be bigger than n times square root of L Planck. And if you translate this to entropy, this means that the entropy has to be bigger than n. So now you can substitute the definition of lambda g of n. And provided that LUV is larger than LSCBH, you get the bound for air L larger than LUV. Okay? So in Einstein gravity, this bound is obeyed. And the trick for proving it for extensions of Einstein gravity is to show that MRS is actually the product MRS is maximal for Einstein. So that we will show next. I don't know. We're actually running short on time. So anyhow, this wasn't meant as a tribute to Perimeter, but it's an experiment, a thought experiment with Alice and Bob, which is in the paper. And it would be a pity not to show it here. So I want to show that LUV is larger than LSCBH. And now I'm doing it ad absurdum, again, the first time that I've done it since high school. But so I'm assuming the opposite, LUV less than LSCBH, and I'm considering two large classical bodies that are approaching each other and forming a black hole. So if this condition is satisfied, then I can have a situation where these two, let's say Bob is riding on one of them, enter their Schwarzschild radius. And this Schwarzschild radius is smaller than LSCBH and larger than the curvature scale. So for this guy, physics is completely classical. He sees low curvature, nothing. Now this guy, because the radius is smaller than LSCBH, right, so sees a very violent decay of what he thinks is a black hole, because at that point, the black hole that he sees is no longer semi-classical. It decays very quickly. Okay, now the key point is that in this case, they can communicate because this is still outside the Schwarzschild radius.
And so if they can communicate, they must agree on the physics. So this situation is impossible. It's usually the way that this contradiction is solved is because the horizon is forming, so they cannot compare. But here, the horizon hasn't formed. Okay, good. So I'll try to wrap it up in 5 minutes. See if we succeed. So this is actually an extremely powerful formula. And this is where I deviate from this parameterization of extension of extensions of Einstein gravity. So what I'm doing here is I'm essentially looking at the one graviton exchange between the black hole and a probe that's approaching it. This is the most general, and here I'm using the flat space approximation, but you can easily generalize to other asymptotes. And this is the most general representation of such a propagator, basically decomposed into the different spins. So this is a massless graviton. These are 5 massive gravitons and any number of scalars that you wish. Now, if the theory, since these are in the usual way related to matrix expectation values of squares of intermediate states, if we're if we are dealing with a Gauss tree and tachyon tree theories, all the parameters that I wrote here are positive. And that is really the key element that I'm using for the proof. So I'm assuming that all the coefficients here are positive for any theory of gravity, and I am assuming that this is the general decomposition. And then now what I'm doing is, again, I'm using perturbation theory to estimate the position of the horizon. So normally in Einstein theory, the position of the horizon would be, so if I'm in the static approximation, it would be at H00 equals minus 1. Right. Now, for the general theory, I can take the Fourier transform of that propagator that I had before, and I get the massless graviton contribution plus stuff. And that stuff, that rho, because I'm assuming no ghost propagating, that rho has to be positive. So this integral has to be positive. Now, if I add an additional assumption that for gravity extended all gravity theories, this I think can be proved, but we haven't really been able to do that. There's a germ of a proof, but we haven't really been able to do that. So it's a mild assumption that if the theory is still perturbative away from the horizon, also for extensions of gravity theory, this certainly holds for all examples that we know, then I can find what RS is from this equation and put it into the relationship between MRS and MRS. And I'm getting for extensions of Einstein theory, see, I'm getting a number here that's larger or equal to 1 because this I was positive. So I've proved that MRS is maximal for I of RS equal to 0, so for Einstein theory. So this means that if I hold RS fixed, the heaviest black hole is in Einstein theory. And if I hold M fixed, the largest horizon is in Einstein theory. And again, if you can actually, in some examples, you can check that. So this essentially completely proves, because it's saying that LSCBH for Einstein is larger than LSCBH for the other theories, for fixed. And I'm almost near the time. Let me just show you that. Let me just quickly say that you can check. It's very hard to find extensions of gravity that are ghost-free, as those of you who worked on higher dimensional or extra dimensional or extensions of gravity know. So there are two interesting examples, interesting non-trivial examples, in compactification model, where if you go with the black hole below the compactification scale, the, let's say, four-dimensional theory becomes extremely complicated, because you're trying to describe a higher dimensional theory in terms of a four-dimensional theory. So you have huge number of Kaluza-Klein. Now, if you have time, I can show you this explicitly. And weakly coupled string theory is another example there. LS is LUV, and the R bound says that that G string squared times N has to be less than one. Now you won't wonder what happens to the Hagedorn increase of states, and that's actually resolved in a very nice way, because only the low lying state, if you count the actual number that goes into evaporation of a black hole, it is only the number of low lying state. It is still interesting, an interesting bound, because this N in some string theories can be quite large, maybe 10 to the 4. So it suggests that there is a bound on G strings that basically produce, making the coming up with the gut scale this way. Okay, consequences. It's a pity that Freddy is not here. He does some of this N equal 8, right? He does. So let's see what are the consequences. Suppose that the bound that I proved is actually correct. So if I take LUV to zero, so lambda UV to infinity, so I'm looking at a fixed theory with a finite number of fixed light states, and I'm sending LUV to zero, so lambda UV to infinity, then in this case I can trans, so the bound says that, and so you see that G Newton has to obey LUV square over N. G Newton has to be less than LUV square over N. So this means that if I send LUV to zero, I have to send G Newton to zero. So this means that you cannot, again, if the bound is correct, you cannot renormalize a theory of gravity with a finite number of states.
So another interesting consequence of the bound is that it is the so-called Sakharov-induced gravity theory, where you send the tree-level G Newton to infinity. It's an induced gravity. It's a usual induced gravity. Okay, and now what the bound says, that the physical G Newtons, so it says that this theory is well defined, because the physical G Newton is finite all the time, finite and bounded. Okay, this we already discussed. And let me skip that, since I already said the main point. Yeah, the other very interesting consequence, which we haven't yet been able to relate in a definite way, is the relationship to entropy bounds. So
in Einstein theory, the black hole entropy is given by M Planck square RS square. RS M bigger than N means that S black hole is bigger than N. So any semi-classical black holes in Einstein theory have to have their entropy bigger than the number of light matter fields. Now, if you think about it, this is actually, on one side, it's not very strange, but on the other side, it is very strange because we are used to thinking about No-Hair theorem and black holes don't care which theory they came from, etc. But here, there is a relationship between the black hole entropy, which is supposedly purely geometric entropy associated with the gravitational solution, and the number of light species, so matter content of the theory. And if that can be shown in general, I think it would be very interesting. And the most interesting case, in fact, is when a saturation occurs. So when S black hole is equal to N, that's the case where the black hole entropy is purely given by entanglement entropy. In that case, the relationship between entropy and matter content become much less surprising. I'll stop here. Thank you.
What do you mean when you say that you cannot renormalize gravity with finite time? Renormalize in which sense? Normal quantum theory sense.
So what this means is
the time as well.
So by that I mean I cannot take lambda, the UV cutoff, lambda to infinity, and still have an interacting gravity theory.
In which theory? In Einstein or in anyone?
Any, if the bound hole for anyone.
This contradicts the common knowledge, let's say, that higher derivative gravity theories are normalizable for dimensions, for instance. In the usual quantum field theory sense, of course, not like this. But you just need normal higher fourth derivative quantum gravity theories.
Yeah.
They are perfectly normalizable for dimensions. Of course, they have both. If you put more derivatives, they are super normalizable. And
but you recall that I'm not allowing Gauss in my series.
Yeah. Well, but then you have this 4-hour gravity example.
4-hour gravity has Gauss. So in some, well, let's not enter into that. Okay. But in any case, the statement is that if our bound forms, this means that a theory that has semi-classical black holes in its spectrum cannot send the cutoff to infinity and still have an interaction theory and keep the black hole solutions.
Yeah, but if you insist that your semi-classical black hole has some sense, then why you speak about normalizing gravity, which means that you go to quantum gravity, so it's different. It's different kind of theories.
No, why? The theories that whose solutions are the semi-classical black holes can be quantum corrected.
Yeah, of course, but these quantum corrections are semi-classical, no?
Yes.
Because semi-classical usually means that gravity is not quantized, and now you start to say...
No. In this case, you can look for solutions. These are semi-classical black hole solutions of the full theory of gravity. If you want to quantize it, you quantize it. And then you'll have some theory. That theory has an effective coupling. And if you have black hole solutions in the spectrum of the theory, then our arguments are wrong.
Any other questions?
Okay, well, let's see. Thank you.